Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. Coming to you today on January 6, 2008. Today we have a terrific show for you. Our guest will be Sut Jolly, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, and one of the leading public intellectuals on media and communication matters in the world today. It's going to be a terrific show, so I hope you join us. For the first 5 minutes, though, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
2007 was a very busy year for media reformers. This week, Media Minutes looks at the top five stories that were generally overlooked by the mainstream media.
Number 5. 2007 was an important year for community radio. In August, hundreds of communities filed applications for full-power non-commercial radio licenses, which would allow them to broadcast at anywhere between 100 and 10,000 watts. Low-power FM also saw several advances. The Bipartisan Local Community Radio Act of 2007 was introduced in both the House and the Senate, which would open the airwaves for more LPFM stations in urban areas. And in December, the FCC released a new set of rules for comment that have the potential to increase protections for LPFM stations across the country.
Number 4. Minority ownership crisis exposed. The FCC has a mandate to increase competition, localism, and diversity. But two landmark studies by Free Press show that the agency didn't even have an accurate account of broadcast radio and television stations owned by women and people of color. The study found that women, who comprise 51% of the population, own less than 6% of all full-power commercial TV and radio stations. And people of color, who comprise a third of the population, own just 7.7% of all full-power commercial radio stations and only about 3% of the nation's TV stations.
Number 3. Net neutrality violators caught in the act. Net neutrality, the guiding principle that prevents internet service providers from discriminating against web content based on its source, ownership, or destination, has been under attack by those who want to control what you see, read, and hear on your favorite sites. In August, AT&T muted Pearl Jam's lead singer, Eddie Vedder, just as he launched into a lyric criticizing President Bush during the live Lollapalooza webcast in Chicago. In September, Verizon Wireless blocked NARAL Pro-Choice America's efforts to send mobile text messages to its own members. After a New York Times expose, the phone company claimed it was a glitch. In October, an Associated Press investigation revealed that cable and broadband company Comcast was secretly blocking peer-to-peer file-sharing programs like BitTorrent and Nutella. Comcast, which faces lawsuits and possibly an investigation by the Federal Communications Commission, claimed they were conducting reasonable traffic management. The fight will heat up in 2008. Net neutrality legislation could be introduced in Congress this month.
Number 2. Giant telecom companies were caught illegally spying on Americans. In August, Director of National Intelligence Mike McConnell disclosed that American telecom companies played a crucial role in an illegal domestic eavesdropping program that had been stopped in January 2007. AT&T and several other carriers are being sued for violating the privacy rights of U.S. citizens. But the Bush administration has been lobbying hard for retroactive immunity for the telcos, and the fight will continue into the new year as Congress finalizes an intelligence bill that will place more intelligence surveillance under the oversight of a secret intelligence court. The House passed a bill that does not grant telco immunity, while the Senate came to an impasse over the issue and put off a December vote.
Number 1. The media ownership fight continues. Throughout the year, ordinary citizens have filled the seats at the FCC's public hearings in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Tampa, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Seattle to testify against further media consolidation. More than 100,000 individuals have contacted Congress. Yet on December 18th, the FCC voted 3-2 to allow one company to own the major newspaper and a TV or radio station in the same city. The decision was met with a firestorm of protest. In just 48 hours, more than 165,000 people signed an open letter to Congress calling for the rules to be overturned. 26 senators, Democrats and Republicans, sent a letter to FCC Chairman Kevin Martin vowing to nullify the rules. And bipartisan legislation that could overturn the rules, the Media Ownership Act of 2007, has been introduced in the Senate and the House. With the public outcry and momentum on Capitol Hill increasing against the FCC, not to mention the likelihood of a fight in the courts, the biggest story of 2007 may very well be one of the biggest stories of 2008 as well.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from sultry Urbana, Illinois, Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We have a live show for you today. And it is a show that I've been looking forward to for a long time. It's someone who hasn't been on the air with us for a few years, but is one of the leading scholars and public figures in the field of communication and media in the United States today. Our guest, Sut Jolly, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, co-founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, author of numerous books and articles, most recently The Spectacle of Accumulation. Sut Jolly, welcome to Media Matters.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon, Bob.
It's really a pleasure to have you back on the air with us. Sut, I hope all goes well for you.
No, things are good for me. Yeah.
Very good. You know, for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with the Media Education Foundation, why don't you give a little background on what it is, when it started, and what you do?
Well, the Media Education Foundation makes and distributes films around the media's impact on society, on culture, on politics, on anything actually. And so we're an independent organization. We produce videos, we produce films on important issues. The one that people may have heard of recently is we just finished a film with Norman Solomon on his book War Made Easy. And that's been doing the rounds at a number of film festivals, and it's actually been opening theatrically as well.
Well, so you might recall that we actually had Norman and Loretta from MEF on Media Matters last summer when the film came out.
Oh, okay. So you know about the film.
Our listeners are up to speed on it.
Yeah. And then we're also working right now on another film to do based on like a Michael Clare's book, Blood and Oil, that makes the link between our foreign policy and our energy policy and how oil has actually been has been absolutely central to that, and we're working on another film to do with the commercialization of children.
And these are all documentaries.
These are all documentaries. We're an independent organization. We produce films that we think are important to produce on important matters, on important topics, and we try and get them distributed, largely to classrooms, largely to universities and to colleges.
And that's where you make your money then, selling them to universities and colleges?
We do. That's where our income comes from, and it actually gives us a level of independence, which is actually very important for us.
Meaning
don't
you don't
worry about whether a certain foundation or a certain foundation officer or people with money will support our work because we have independent income coming in. I mean, we would love to get money. Don't get me wrong, we would love to get money to support our work as well. But because the base of our work comes in from our sales, we can really do films that we think on topics that we think are important, rather than have to worry about where the money is going to come from.
How many films do you do generally in the course of a year?
It varies depending upon the complexity of them, but two or three at least. Sometimes we've done up to five in 1 year.
And Media Education Foundation has been around since the early 90s, hasn't it?
This is our 16th year, actually. We started in 1991. And let me just tell you the story of how we started, because people may not be aware of it. I was, and I still am a professor at the University of Massachusetts. And, you know, in 1990, and I was teaching these large lecture classes, you know, a long time ago on Intro to Mass Comm, and I was trying to figure out how do you get young people to really kind of connect with the kind of issues that I wanted to, you know, wanted to deal with. And at that time, MTV was absolutely central to the culture. And there was an evolving debate around images of sexuality and images of women on MTV. And so I started to produce materials around that issue. Okay, if you can get people to think in some kind of analytical way around these issues, which are very important to them. These are not just peripheral issues. These are issues that they're connected with. That will be a way to for them to see how central media and media images are in the construction of identity and how they understand the world. And so I started to produce this. I started to, you know, bring in materials into my classroom from MTV videos to look at these things. And over a course of a period of time, I actually developed a standalone film, which was called Dreamworld, which looked at images of MTV and its connection with sexual violence and sexual attitudes. And so that was in 1991, and MEF didn't exist at this time. And I thought, well, you know, if this film is useful to me in my classes, perhaps it'll be useful to some other people as well. And I did a very small mailing to some, to some other communication departments, to women's studies departments, to sociology departments, you know, and distributed a few films in that way, with the money coming in through the department. And then lo and behold, one day, this was in 1990, I got a letter from the legal department, actually, at MTV Networks, telling me to cease and desist what I was doing because I was using their copyrighted images in my own work. This was a fairly serious letter. You know, when you have a major, global company telling you that they're going to take you to court, it's not something to take lightly.
Yeah, I'm sure they weren't getting lawyers off of day labor list either.
No. This was. I mean, we know they have standing lawyers who do this stuff all the time. Then the letter came, and I was actually quite pretty confident. I was on very solid legal ground because, you know, there's something called fair use within the Copyright Act, which says if you're using someone else's copyrighted materials for purposes of criticism, review, teaching, etc., then you're perfectly within the law to do it. It's actually there's not that many great laws in the United States, but the Copyright Act actually is not a bad law because it recognizes both, you know, intellectual property, but it also says under certain conditions that, you know, that control that property does not reside with those people who made it. So it gives scholars and gives analysts, you know, room to, in fact, use those materials to critique and to analyze. And I was very sure that I was on very solid legal ground. Unfortunately, the letter came both to myself and to the university as well. And so university lawyers got involved. And they weren't as sure and they weren't as kind of supportive. And essentially, I set up MEF, the Media Education Foundation, to separate myself off from the bureaucrats at the university. So that, you know, I could make these decisions without having to worry about what some, you know, incompetent lawyer was thinking somewhere. And so that's how MEF started, was actually just to distribute this one tape, this one film that I had, to separate myself from the university. And then over the years, as we've, you know, I sold that tape, money came in, we made another one. Over the years, you know, we've now made around 55 films.
And for the average film, or just pick one of your recent films, how many students might see one of these over the course of a year or two?
It's difficult to tell, but what we hear from librarians is that our films are actually very popular across a range of different departments. And so I think for example, something like Dreamworld, which has now been out for 15 years. Actually, I've just done a new version that's just gone out in the last 6 months. I think conservatively, you know, millions of students would have seen it over the years.
Mm-hmm. Now, the cost of these...
This is not a bad... I actually like the fact that they're shown in classrooms because it's in one sense, it's a captive audience. You know, these are people who wouldn't otherwise, they wouldn't pay their money to go and see this somewhere. They certainly wouldn't go and pay their money to go and see a documentary. So in one sense, you're exposing people to material that they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. And I think in that sense, the classroom is a great place to do that kind of education. Because you're forcing new materials. You're forcing people to think about issues that they wouldn't otherwise think about. So not only does it work for us financially to be able to sell to universities, but I actually think it's a great place to do education as well.
Our guest, Sut Jolly, who you've just been listening to, Sut Jolly is a professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, the organization that produces films for colleges and universities on media and communication and social issues, and a noted scholar on advertising and communication with a new book out, The Spectacle of Accumulation. Sut Jolly is graciously speaking with us today from the MEF headquarters in Northampton, Massachusetts, nearby where Sut lives. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Sut Jolly, the telephone number here at WILL-AM580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And I think, Sut Jolly, as I go through the list of films that you personally have either produced or directed or written for the Media Education Foundation, or the ones that just have been produced that you've sort of had a looser hand on, it covers a broad range of issues, but I want to talk about some of these because I know you've given a lot of thought and done a lot of work on these. But in particular, an area that has, I think, been central to your work and has increased in importance, if anything, in the past few years, has been the whole role of advertising in our society and commercialization. What attracted you to advertising as an area of study, and what do you think most Americans get about it and don't get about it?
Well, what attracted me to it was central to the way in which our society was functioning, and yet there was very little academic work that had been done on it. I mean, in fact, until Stuart Ewan in the late 1970s, wrote Captains of Consciousness, it really didn't even present itself as a serious topic of study. So it was something that I thought was absolutely central, and yet had not been studied at all, and people weren't really looking at it in a close way. So that's what drew me to it. And it's a difficult topic to talk about because everyone thinks they're an expert on advertising because everyone is always exposed to it. People talk about it, young people especially. And especially with advertising today, actually playing on this notion that they've been exposed to advertising their entire lives, there's always this kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, we know that you're not going to be taken in by any of this. So everyone thinks they're an expert, and it's difficult to get people to take it seriously. So that's the difficult part of when you deal with advertising, is that people already come to it with very, very strong opinions. And I think what we have to do is, Marshall McLuhan once said, we're not too sure who discovered water, but we're pretty sure it wasn't the fish. And I think the job of analysts and the job of teaching is to get people to see the water, and to get people to take one step back from this world that they're just engulfed in, these thousands of messages that they get every day. How do you get them to, which has become the environment, which has become the air that we breathe, how do you get them to take one step back and to see the air and to see the water and to see what effect that it has on them?
What is the problem with advertising and the role it plays in our society?
Well, I think advertising has become, our culture. Most people think, when they think about the power of advertising, they think, ads if they get us to buy a product, then they're powerful, and if they don't get us to buy a product, then they're not powerful. And I think actually even progressives have kind of fallen into that way of thinking about it, that somehow the power of advertising is dependent upon whether it, gets us to buy a product or not buy a product. And I think that's an interesting, Anheuser-Busch or if you're Pepsi, that's an interesting question to ask. Does my advertising actually work? But if you're actually interested in the social role of advertising, I think it's the wrong question to ask. And what we should really be asking is, what are the values? What are the stories that advertising is spinning as it tries to sell us these things? And I think the major problem with advertising is that what it's providing to the world is a commodity-centered view of the world. That is, it's saying that you will become happy through buying a commodity, or you will become happy through the marketplace. And in that sense, it's the propaganda of the marketplace. And I think in that sense, it goes to the central core of a lot of issues, especially the issue of how do we become happy, is increased consumption connected to that, and what other effects does increased consumption have? And I think now that we have this whole debate around global warming, we're now starting to see what the environmental effects of this are. And also, to what extent is our foreign policy connected to the search, to the desire for more and more commodities and the desire to make sure that we can produce more and more commodities. So I think advertising is one of those central features of our life that people pay no attention to.
Sut Jolly, who you've just been listening to, among other things, has been voted the best professor at the University of Massachusetts by the students there. It's won a Distinguished Teaching Award and was awarded the Distinguished Outreach Award. So a highly acclaimed teacher. We're privileged to have him as our guest today on Media Matters. We're talking about advertising, an area that he's done a lot of popular work on and scholarship on. And you alluded just now, Satjali, to the connection of advertising to the environmental crisis facing our species. And, you know, you made a film of, it's almost a decade ago, I think, at this point, Advertising the End of the World, which was the first time I ever saw that linkage made. And it was, I think, for my money, one of the most powerful documentaries I've ever seen. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that's the, when you think about the idea of, that advertising spins all the time, which is that, you know, stuff will make us happy. And that more stuff will make us more happy. I mean, that is the central story that is spun, not actually it's by advertising, but also by the market system. And I think actually it's the central idea that is now circulating around the world. It's a central idea that is pushing growth, you know, around the world, whether it's in the West or whether it's in China or whether it's in India, whether it's in other parts of Asia. And the issue, the question we also have to ask is, if, you know, is that true? Does more stuff make us more happy? But the connected issue is, well, if we're going to have more stuff, if that's the formula, more things, more commodities, well, where is that going to come from? What are the resources that are going to be used to make more stuff? What is the energy that's going to be required to do it? And I think we're now starting to realize that there are physical limits to how much we can use the earth to produce these resources or to produce these commodities. And especially with the role of oil, with oil being so central to how we're producing these things, as we are now running out of oil, and as we, I think the world most probably has already peaked in terms of oil production, what is that going to do to how we think about our lives in the future? And to what extent does advertising, you know, deflect us away from thinking about the things we really need to think about? In that sense, I think advertising, it's like a drug dealer. That's the metaphor that I use. In that it's always pushing us towards things for satisfaction, you know. And even though we know the things don't really give us satisfaction, that the things don't really make us happy, it's there on the street corner, you know, come on, just another hit, come on, just one more time. And it deflects us away from really thinking about environmental issues. It deflects us away from thinking about how we can become really happy. And I think that's a really good question to ask. You know, how do, if you want to create a world that will make the most number of people the most happy, what form would it take? And it deflects us away from thinking about those issues.
Our guest, Satjali, I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580, a live show coming to you from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Telephone number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Satjali.
Hi. I so totally agree with what you're saying about advertising. Now, I may be a little inaccurate here, but my understanding is that for businesses, you deduct expenses from and then pay taxes on your net profit. So in other words, advertising is free to big companies. Is that correct? And I've never heard anyone talk about that. Isn't that a way maybe of getting at this problem?
I wouldn't say it's free, but it is tax deductible, which means that it is, you know, it is financed by the public.
And also the other side of the coin, if I'm not mistaken, in states where businesses do advertising, it's not covered by sales tax, where other expenditures would be.
Yes, I mean, so there is a big public subsidy that is given to advertising. That's given to business when they advertise. And I think one of the things that could mean what I think one of the things you have to do in the future is to reduce the role that advertising plays in our daily lives. And I think actually one way you could do that is to take away that subsidy, is to take away that exemption so that, in fact, if businesses have to pay tax on it, there actually would be less tax. There would be less advertising. and there would be they wouldn't have as much sway, not only in our daily lives but also upon the media and the editorial content of media. So you're absolutely right. I mean, when we think about advertising, it is not just this thing the business does. It is, you know, we have given. I mean, essentially, we by giving businesses this tax deduction, we are saying that, you know, the public is going to, that there is a value in what business is doing around advertising. And I think what advertisers have to do is to show us that there is some value. And what businesses have to do is show us that there is some value in what they're doing and in the communication that they, you know, that they're putting together. I think that's a very, very difficult thing for them to do. But I think your basic point is very important to realize is that, in fact, we are supporting, that there are policies, tax policies, that support more and more advertising.
And the amount of advertising in our nation, do you know offhand what the expenditures annually in 2006 or 2007 were for advertising or marketing in the economy set?
There's somewhere in the region, like in the United States, they're in the region of $250 billion.
That's serious money.
Sorry?
That's serious money.
That is serious money.
And that subsidizes much of our media system, which is, of course, why it's such an important theme for people interested in media. You know, you've got the new video, Sat Jolly, coming out with the Media Education Foundation on the commercialization of childhood. And this seems to me, from my own work and from teaching some of the same classes you teach, although I teach at Illinois, an area of extraordinary importance and where advertising is perhaps most sensitive.
No, I agree. I think it's, it is, I mean, looking at, I don't see how you could get at any more central topic than how our kids are going to be raised and the environment within which they're going to be raised. And one of the things I'm kind of just stunned about is how much or how little debate there is on this. I mean, it's like we've given over our kids to these marketers, and we've said, you know, use them for whatever you want to use them for. I think it's one of the really scandalous areas in the society. Marketers have realized, and what advertisers have realized, is that kids have a lot of money and that they influence a lot of money. They have about $30 billion of their own money, and so advertisers are targeting them directly. But they also... that what advertisers or what marketers have realized is that the children also influence about $700 billion of consumption of their parents. And so what advertisers are trying to do is, in fact, get in there and to turn them into lobbyists for products against their parents. It is one of the most insidious things that I think you can think of is we've let in business. I mean, we've essentially encouraged businesses to come between parents and their children.
You know, Sat Jolly, you hear now we're in campaign season and we're getting the usual speeches and lectures from politicians about family values and how much they love families and religious values and morality and ethics. I never hear this crowd talk about, you know, the hyper-commercialization of childhood as anything that, you know, has anything to do with ethics or morality.
No, it's outrageous. I mean, I think this is the central issue to do. I mean, I wish there was more when we talk about media. I wish we talked much more about morality and about values, because I think that actually is the central thing. And actually, around this issue, there are actually people who, you know, you and I would consider, you know, a right wing, who in fact are quite concerned about this because they actually see advertising and business as the central thing that is destroying family life. And if you're really concerned about family values and if you're really concerned about having healthy families, whatever they may be, you've got to be concerned about what businesses and corporations are doing to come into the middle of families and essentially tearing families apart. I think there may be actually a way to get a coalition between that is not the normal left-right coalition around this, which is, you know, how do we protect our kids from what I think are predators? The more and more I talk about this, you know, my language starts to kind of get hyped up. But I think we should call children's marketers what they are, which is they are predators and they are child abusers, and they're trying to get into they're trying to turn kids against their parents. And again, one of the things we now know, there's a great book that's been written. Actually, there's a number of books that have been written. Susan Lin wrote a book called Consuming Kids, and that's going to be the title of our new film. And Julia Chaw, wrote a book called Born to Buy.
And they've both been guests on Media Matters talking about those books.
Oh, okay, so again, your guests, your listeners will know something about them. But I think one of the most important pieces of research that has been done is by Juliet Shaw. You know, and what she's found is that the more kids are in are involved in commercial culture, the more unhealthy they are, both physically and psychologically, and the worse their relationships are with their parents. I mean, it seems to me, you know, insane for society to organize itself in that way, to organize itself in a way to that actually is to the detriment of kids and to the detriment of families.
And if I'm not mistaken, please correct me if I'm wrong, advertising to children and commercial sort of attacks on children or approaches to children, pick your term, have really increased dramatically faster than other aspects of advertising in the past two decades.
And no, absolutely. The more that the marketers have realized that is where the future lies, and the more they've realized how much influence children have on family purchases.
Because you know,
kids are now being targeted, you know, by car advertisers. You know, 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds are being targeted by car advertisers because they've realized that kids have an influence in how cars are being bought by families.
You know, I growing up in the 1950s and 60s, looking back on it, it was probably like growing up in Bulgaria under communism in terms of commercial exposure compared to what my daughters have grown up with in the 90s and in this decade, where there are, you know, 3 or 4 24/7 commercial TV channels aimed at them, websites permeated with marketing, just advertising and commercial messages everywhere.
No, absolutely, and it has become much, much worse. We have to remember there's an historical aspect to this. You know, until the 1960s, there was actually no marketing to kids. It was actually television that actually first linked kids to the market. Before then, you know, there was kids weren't being marketed to directly. But since television and now especially with the internet, I don't think parents realize how much. I think parents don't realize they've let in the predators and they've let in the child abusers inside the home. You know, there's a lot of talk about how to keep kids safe, and you know, and you make sure that your houses are safe, and you lock the doors, etc., and you lock the windows. We haven't quite realized that, in fact, when we do that, we've actually locked the abusers inside the home, and that when kids are spending, in the research that Juliet Shaw talks about, when kids are spending 8.5 hours a day on some form of media, and most of which is commercialized media, and parents have no idea what's going on there. I mean, we've essentially let someone else raise our kids. And as you say, this has become much, much more intense over the years.
Our guest today is Sat Jolly, the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts, author of numerous books and articles, most recently The Spectacle of Accumulation. We're talking about a broad range of issues that Sat Jolly's work and his films have covered over the years. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now and go to line one, another caller from Urbana for Sat Jolly.
Professor Jolly, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. I grew up in an advertising family, and I know just how cynical advertising artists are. I mean, they're as a category, they're virtually unchallenged. The whole idea of advertising art is to make people feel bad so that they'll consume the commodity in order to feel good. Theoretically, fine art is supposed to make you feel good. Advertising art is designed to make you feel bad. And I've always appreciated your work. Now, how do we get your documentaries out to the general public besides just university students? For example, Link TV or Free Speech TV. I've only had satellite for a brief period, and I've never seen one of your films, and I'd love to. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, thank you. I mean, advertisers are cynical. I mean, I think one of the most depressing aspects of this is, I mean, there are, in advertising is where all the creative, not where all the creative people are, but there's a lot of creative people in advertising. And they would much rather be, you know, writing the great American novel or making the great American film, except there's no money in that. And so what they're doing is that all that creativity is being used, you know, to sell us beer and pimple cream and, you know, and whatever else. I think in the future, you know, when aliens from Mars come down and they're looking at the rubble of our society, the civilization, they'll say, they did what? they took the most creative people in the society, and they got them to, and they said that your job is to get people to buy all this, you know, all this crap, And you can do it in whatever way you want, and you can go into anyone's home whenever you want to go into, which is essentially what advertisers do through media. I think they'll be just amazed. Like, how do you organize this? How did any civilization end up in that way? And I think the aim should be is how do you create context, and how do you create opportunities for creative people to be able to express themselves in some other way, to be able to express themselves perhaps with a different set of values. And I think that's got, again, not to do with us in terms of what we think is important and how we organize a society. In answer to the second question, our stuff actually is shown on Link and on Free Speech TV quite a bit. And we also try and get stuff out to public libraries as much as we can. But again, this is a broader issue on distribution of this kind of material, out to a broader public. Again, one of the things I think using a kind of old language, the means of production have been democratized now. And what I mean by that is that, you know, making a film actually is relatively easy to do. You can actually make a very high-level film because the means of production, that is a good camera and some good editing, you can get them for a few thousand dollars. And so there's incredible stuff that's being made around the country and around the world right now because those things have really come down in price. What hasn't been democratized are the means of distribution and how you get this stuff out. And so organizations like, you know, Media Education Foundation, we have to kind of work with, you know, between the cracks, because there's no way we can actually get into the mainstream media with this message because it is so controlled by corporations and by advertisers. And what we really have to do, and again, Bob McChesney is one of the central figures in this, is to really think about how we organize our media system and to really think about media reform in a serious way so that we can actually diversify and broaden out the kind of messages that people can be exposed to.
Our guest, Sut Jolly, today here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Professor Jolly, I'm a big fan. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us here. Sure, I'm interested in hearing more on issues of resistance to consumer culture, particularly in relationship to the role of schools in fostering what you write about in terms of critical media literacy. And this being in the context of, you know, the Bush administration's push on No Child Left Behind, standardized curriculum, high-stakes testing, and rote memorization.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very important thing to think about. In one sense, it's the only, education and critical viewing skills and critical literacy, I mean, it's the only thing that we have, because there's no way that we can compete with the billions of dollars that are being spent trying to influence us. So all that we can do is, in fact, to give people the tools to be able to see what's being done to them, so that, in fact, that incredible power, all those billions of dollars can be turned back on themselves. And the way to do that, as I said, is to get people to take this one step back, away from this environment that they're in. And I think if you can do that, then the billions of dollars are not going to be as effective. And also, we have to get people to look at the world clearly. But at the same time, I think we also have to realize that these corporations who control our culture, they realize how important monopoly is. They realize that if they let anyone else in there, that it's actually with a different vision, then in fact the game is going to be over. And they do all they can to make sure, through their censorship of the media, to make sure that there is not going to be any other significant voice out there that's going to compete with their own ideas and their own visions. And therefore, I think it's a two-stage thing. When you talk about resistance, it's two-stage. On the one hand, it's education. On one hand, it's media literacy, it's media education, trying to get people to look at the world and to understand exactly what's going on. I think that is old-fashioned liberal education, what used to be called liberal education. And at the same time, I think you also have to now struggle over the means of communication. You have to say that the reason the media have the power they have is because we've given it to them, and it's now time to take it back. So I think you have to do both of those things in terms of resistance.
Now, Sut Jolly, what about the Internet? Doesn't it solve the distribution problems and sort of set us all free?
Well, the Internet is, if you look at it and see who controls it, it's the same companies that are controlling the Internet. And I think that's often what what people have said about the left. I think the Internet is absolutely fantastic for organizing. And I don't think there's... Let me give you an example, a very particular example of its potential, but then also of its limitation. which is before the Bush administration, before they invaded Iraq. You may remember in February of 2003, there were these protests that took place all over the world, and there were 14 million people out on the streets, and that would not have been possible without the internet. That would not have been possible without the internet being used to organize people to get out on the streets. At the same time, how did the vast majority of the people in the country understand, or how did they hear about those protests? Well, they heard about them through the corporate media, and so we were at the mercy at that point. Those people who were out in the streets protesting this illegal and immoral war, we were at the mercy of the corporate media, because again, the internet is a fantastic tool if you know already that the media system in general is biased in a very, very particular way. And if you don't know that, if you think the media system is free or if there's some diversity in it, then the internet is simply being used to reproduce what's already there. So I think the internet is both a potential, but it is not going to be the solution to the question of distribution. To the question of the issue of distribution will be dealt with when we really think about television, when we really think about radio, when we really think about the major means of communication that still exist in the society and how to make them more democratic.
Bob McChesney here. You're listening to Media Matters. Our guest, Sut Jolly. We still have time for other callers if people want to call in at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I want to wrap up, Sut Jolly, on the question of pharmaceutical advertising now to finish up our talk about advertising, because you've done some work on that. And this, again, is a fairly new arena in American life, or re-emerging arena might be a better way to put it. What's going on there?
Yeah, again, we've just finished the film, it was about a year ago, called Big Bucks, Big Pharma, which was to look, dealing with how corporations, how especially pharmaceutical industry, has changed the way we think about illness. And again, I think it's one of the most important things to think about, because things have changed in the last 10 years. Starting in around 1997. You started to get an increasing number of ads directed at consumers. It was called direct-to-consumer advertising. Because, for pharmaceutical ads, things that are prescription-driven, the people that they used to target, and they still do in a very concentrated way, were doctors. Because, doctors have to write the scripts. Doctors have to write the prescriptions. And so most of the promotional work that pharmaceutical advertisers, pharmaceutical companies did was towards doctors. Starting in the late 1990s, you started to see the change in that. And people have most probably seen these now that, you turn on the evening news or you turn on the evening television and people are bombarded with ads for pharmaceutical, for prescription drugs. And again, I think the question people have to answer or have to ask is, well, how did this happen? What happened in the late 1990s that changed the way that we think about drugs? And what happened was that there were laws, there were some regulations that were changed that said that pharmaceutical companies didn't have to give all the side effects in any ad that they put out. And so they could now use that television advertising, and they essentially started to use television advertising to make pharmaceutical products have a kind of emotional relationship with consumers. They started to brand them. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much what these drugs did, it was how we felt about them. And again, the major aim is to get us to walk into a doctor's office and to ask for the drug that's been advertised. And in that sense, it's a very, very important change. Before it used to be doctors, patients, and now you've suddenly got someone else in there as well, which is marketers. And they're trying to change that relationship between patients and doctors. As a result, the number of scripts, the number of prescriptions that have been written has increased dramatically in the last 10 years, as has the amount of money that's gone into advertising. And I think what it means is that people actually are much more drugged up than they need to be. People are taking many more drugs, and often for things that they don't need, and not really thinking clearly about their health. And that is what the advertising has done, is it has confused people about ways of living healthy.
Our guest, Sut Jolly. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Farina, Illinois, you're on the air with Sut Jolly.
Hi, thanks. Another interesting show. I'm in a great mood. I I saw a really entertaining film this morning called Phantom of the Operator, about the history of the phone companies, and it was just excellent. They used some of their own, the company's own training and promotional materials, and it's just hilarious, and then told a bigger story. And I wondered if you'd seen that movie. Also, another one I saw recently that I just really loved, American Ruling Class. It's got Howard Zinn and just a great host of people in that. Just one other comment, since you were talking about advertising to children, I think the most obnoxious ads I've seen lately and are these ones for the armed services, the ones that target the high school age, people and so forth, with the Marines and the Army. It's just complete. Some of them are good, but some of them are just, to me, obnoxious. And I'd like if you could comment if you'd seen those, either one of those two films, The American Ruling Class or The Phantom of the Operator. I'd really recommend either one to you or the audience. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you, caller. And Sachali, before you answer, let me just let our listeners know, if they're not familiar with this, that militarism and U.S. foreign policy is one of the main themes of Media Education Foundation work. So I'd be interested in hearing your response to his points about militarism as well.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the two films that have been mentioned, but again, that doesn't surprise me. As I said, the means of communication, the means of production have been democratized, and there are actually so many films out there now. The question, as I go back to again, is how do we get them out? And I think what progressives have to do is really start thinking about distribution seriously. Just making a film is not enough. If people don't see the film that you've made, you're not engaged in politics. You're engaged in something else. And what we have to really do is to start thinking, again, as you have, Bob, in terms of the organization that you founded, Free Press, really start thinking about the media system and who has control of it, and how do we get some diversity into that? How do we get some democracy into that? That is, I think, really the key question that that the progressives on the left have to answer. In terms of militarism, again, we are, Dwight Eisenhower said, we're a military-industrial complex, a long time ago. In fact, I think I would say we're the military-industrial media complex now, given how central militarism has become military issues are to how the media itself is organized as well, and to the themes that we see in media all the time. To the extent that they're targeting kids with these ads, we know if you live in a militarized society, you've got to have people in the military. You've got to have more and more people in the military. Without a draft, you've got to convince them somehow that the reason to go into the military has to do with noble reasons of patriotism, etc., instead of the real reasons, which is to go and protect the resources of oil for our ruling classes. Then you're going to use the most sophisticated propaganda that's out there. And I think that's actually one of the most interesting questions, is on what basis do kids sign up for the military? On what basis do people sign up? What do they think they're going to do when they sign up? People, I think, sign up for all kinds of noble reasons that have nothing to do with the actual reasons for why America has the biggest military the world has ever seen.
We have a full bank of callers for Sachali. I'm going to try to get to all of you before the show ends. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Let's go to line one, Indianapolis, Indiana. You're on the air with Sachali.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here with you. I've been listening for a little bit, and from what it sounds like, you're kind of in this idea that everybody who's susceptible to these commercials and falls for them is, I guess, not as smart as what you think they should be, especially that comment about the military. That to me, after you're telling these 18-year-olds that if you fall for one of these commercials, you're not really that bright, which we've heard some politicians say that before, and they had to backtrack. Secondly, I believe in the on-off button, and that's pretty much how I raise my kids. They don't sit around and watch TV all day. But if they do and they see a commercial, explain to them. There's savvy salesmen out there every once in a while. And then lastly, I believe you said that basically you can't compete with the corporate media, as you say, which means basically you don't have enough money to do anything with it. I'm kind of curious now as to what you think your ends are in order to get your statement out there without, you know, affecting the market or without suppressing the corporations and whatnot from being able to advertise. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, caller.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure I got to all of them, but, I mean, the issue of I don't think people are very bright. I actually don't think it's an issue of whether people are bright or not. It's an issue of the environment within which people make decisions and how those decisions are constricted before they even start thinking about them. So I don't think the brightness has anything to do with it. I think people are very smart, but you know, we're only as smart as the environment within which we operate, and the decisions we can make are the decisions that have been defined already as what is possible. I think people don't know enough about how the media system operates and how a culture operates. I don't think that's a matter of brightness and not being bright. I think that's just the way the education system has worked. And one of the things I've done in my life is to say that the most important thing that you can do, in fact, is to let people know exactly the world they live in. And at that point, they can make decisions. They can make moral, ethical decisions based on all the facts. And if you can, you know, I never tell my students what they should do. I don't think that's our job as educators. I think our job as educators is to get people to see the world the most clear that it can be seen, and then they make their own decisions based on their own moral and ethical values. And again, it has nothing to do with whether I think they're dumb or not dumb, etc. It has to do with what kind of depends with what kind of resources they have. In terms of the on-off switch, I agree. I mean, the caller sounds like a very thoughtful person who wants to engage with his children around these issues. And again, I don't think it's an issue of on-off. The issue is we live, and it's like when the whole environment is polluted. What single individuals do within that is not really the point. The question is, if the air is polluted, how do you get the air to become clean again? So that's an issue that individuals by themselves can't deal with. That's an issue to do with power. That's an issue to do with politics. And again, I think we have to think about the media environment in that way, which is how do we get the media environment to become much more democratic.
Let's go back to the phone lines now for two callers who've been waiting patiently. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Sat Jolly.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Excuse me. I'm glad to hear you talk about pollution of the environment because... I think you're onto something there. It's you might also refer to it as pollution of our culture. And it seems to me advertising has infected all of our institutions. And you've already touched on some of those, healthcare, family. But I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about education, because it seems to me that our education system has completely accepted all things associated with advertising. Advertising is now taught within our universities. In many cases, if not all, it's part of journalism or communications or media studies or whatever they're calling it these days. So if you will, I'd like to hear your thoughts about advertising as a form of... form of the mass communications institution that is actually being promulgated and acceptable. So I'd appreciate that. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Yeah, thank you, caller. And, Sat, if I could add to that, if you could really talk about the caliber of communication research, in your view, and education in American universities, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, I think there's two issues when you talk about education and advertising. One is that advertisers have turned their gaze towards educational institutions and are now, marketing is permeating educational institutions now, whether it is universities and colleges or whether it's high schools. And we actually did a film on this called Captive Audience about advertising in high schools and about, again, essentially how, how students have been are targeted as a captive audience by advertisers. So that's one issue. The other issue is, to do with what's taught at American universities, what's taught at in terms of advertising and marketing. And again, I think the caller is absolutely right. The kinds of issues that I'm dealing with, which is, calling attention to advertising as a powerful social institution, not simply as an economic institution, those courses are very, very few and far between. Most of the way in which American universities, American colleges have looked at advertising and marketing is from a very practical basis, which is it's not the issue of, you know, how do we understand it from a societal perspective, but it's how do we do it better? How do we train people to be able to do it better? You know, there are schools, I mean, schools of marketing, schools of business. I mean, almost every university has one. And people like, you know, Bob McChesney and myself, who are dealing with advertising and dealing with hyper-commercialism and dealing with media from another perspective. I mean, we're a very, very small minority in media, in education. Again, this idea that, you know, all educators, you know, people who work in universities and colleges have come out, are somehow left-wing radical is so far off the mark. Most of the people who work in universities, in fact, I think, toe a very, very mainstream line and actually represent the status quo in pretty direct ways.
So, Charlie, let's see if we have time to get to our final caller from Line 3 in Champaign County. Are you there, caller?
Don't know what to do with these last couple of minutes after the last call, but I'd like to just point out that American exceptionalism seems to include something that nobody really else in the world does at the scale that we do, which is the advertising to children and the advertising of drugs. This was both discussed. As far as the distribution, I've just watched Power of Nightmares, and I recommend that to people. I haven't watched all of the work of this fellow, but it's right up there with the catastrophe film that Sut Jolly and crew did right in the aftermath of the 9-1-1. I'll just appreciate both of your work and keep up the efforts. Thanks.
Well, thank you, caller.
Okay. Thanks. The Power of Nightmares is a very good film to do with the role of the connection between Islamic fundamentalism and the neoconservatives in America. And again, I highly recommend it.
You know, Sut Jolly, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I'd like to stand back for a second. You've lived in the United States for about two decades now, having been raised in Britain, educated at the graduate level in Canada. What is your take on how has the United States changed in the 20 years or so you've been here?
I think the corporate kind of stranglehold on America has become actually much greater. And partly that is, I think that is, you know, it's kind of frustrating because I think the right and businesses have realized how central media and communication is, and they've actually put a lot of resources into media and communication. The right has realized how important storytelling is, and the left, on the other hand, even though the left has, again, one of the, people often ask me why I live in the United States, and I think it's, you know, both the best and the worst of everything. I mean, I think if you're going to fight these fights, you need to do it in the belly of the beast, and this is the beast. But I also think there's a lot of very good work that's being done here, but it's being done on the margins. It's being done on the peripherals, on the periphery. And I think what's really changed is I think this culture has become much more corporatized in the last 20 years, and has become much more militarized in the last 20 years. And I think we have less access to ideas, less access to diversity than we did 20 years ago. And I think that is what is at stake. What's at stake is America, you know, going to be a democracy, or is it going to be an empire? And what we've seen in the last 20 years is it's movement towards the direction of empire. An empire and democracy cannot function together.
Our guest today has been Sut Jolly. Sut, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Sut Jolly, professor of communication at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and also the founder and executive director of the Media Education Foundation. You can find him all over the internet, author of the recent book, The Spectacle of Accumulation. It's been a real honor and pleasure having you join us for the last hour, Sut Jolly.
Likewise, Bob. It's always a pleasure.
And listeners, I want to let you know I'll be back 1 week from today with Juan Gonzalez as my guest. I want to thank Colleen Cook for sitting in today as my producer, and Matt Kessler for running the board. See you all in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with patchy drizzle and a slight chance of rain, an unseasonably mild high in the upper 50s with south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with a chance of showers after midnight, the low in the mid-50s with south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, cloudy with a chance of showers, the high in the lower 60s, breezy with south winds 20 to 25 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. As the presidential race moves forward, today we'll listen back to a unique debate focusing on concerns of people of color. Today we rebroadcast the Democratic edition of the All-American Presidential Forum.
Well, I really believe that it takes a village to raise a child, and the American village has failed our children.
The starting place is to understand that there is no one single cause of poverty.
When you've got a bill called No Child Left Behind, you can't leave the money behind for No Child Left Behind.
On this special rebroadcast, we'll hear from all the initial Democratic candidates, Senator Hillary Clinton, Senator Joe Biden, Governor Bill Richardson, Senator John Edwards, Senator Barack Obama, Senator Mike Gravel, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and Senator Chris Dodd. It's the All-American Presidential Forum on PBS on the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI. After the news.